My first guest is no stranger to the FAA. He has served on its Management Advisory Council since 2001 and has participated in a Department of Transportation review of FAA safety oversight within the airline industry. His airline experience is deep and distinguished. As a pilot for 25 years with Eastern Airlines and in various high-level positions with the Airline Pilots Association, including 8 years as its president. Mr. Babbitt was confirmed as the FAA's 16th administrator in June of last year. Please welcome FAA Administrator Randy Babbitt.
Thank you. Thank you. Great to be here.
And we thank you for coming. You've been here since Tuesday, enjoying the sights. Some impressions of some of the things you've seen?
Well, if you're interested in aviation, you just have to be here. And it's awfully hard to describe to people. Everyone here in the audience certainly knows what goes on here. But this is where the passion of aviation and the innovation and all the wonderful things that people enjoy about flying come together. And you get to share it with people of your same thinking. So it's just a great place to be if you like airplanes.
That's right. And you went and made a flight with Jeff Skiles and Sully Sullenberger in a really classic airliner. So what was it like for all three of the airline pilots to be in that particular airplane yesterday?
Well, when you were talking about the DC-7 flight we made yesterday, of course, and when all four engines were running, it was like we were put into a backwards time machine. It just put us back about 1955, right then and there. It was awesome. Particularly a great flight for me because, one, I was an Eastern pilot. Second, my dad was an Eastern pilot, and he actually flew that airplane. So it was really a thrill for me to take part in that great restoration flight.
With just over a year on the job, how has your experiences so far colored your perception of the American aviation system?
Well, it confirms for me, we all know it, but it absolutely confirms and reinforces what an incredibly safe system we have. I'm just dazzled by the breadth and the depth of the things that the FAA does, the great people that work there. I'm really honored to work with such a great bunch of folks. And the mission that they pursue of ensuring the safety of our system and our passengers and equipment, it really has been brought to the forefront in me, being able to see it up close. So it's a wonderful opportunity, and I've enjoyed my first year there.
And we're all very proud of our aviation system. What is the role of the FAA around the world? In many ways, the agency is at the forefront of aviation, and in other areas, the rest of the world is leading the way. What can we learn from other aviation systems around the world?
Well, we have and continue to develop great partnerships around the world. We have clearly the safest system in the world. Our technology is absolutely a marvel. We're going to move over 2 million people commercially today. We're going to conduct about 100,000 flight operations today, and we're going to do it every day, year-round. And it's a marvelous safety record, and it's the envy of the world. And we take our expertise, and we're happy to export technology and knowledge to other countries and help them raise the standards of safety. But at the same time, the partnerships that we have with our international colleagues often shine light on technological improvements they have made and that we can adopt. And so it's a great opportunity, and I think we need to continue the emphasis to communicate and collaborate with our worldwide partners.
The FAA took a huge step this past April in allowing the use of antidepressants by pilots. This initiative began before you were named administrator. Based on your extensive professional pilot experience, would you have advocated for this kind of policy?
Yes, I would have. Remember, you were kind to mention some of my background. As an airline pilot, we adopted a program back in the 70s, and I was part of the representation structure. It was the HIMSS program. And the HIMSS program, for the audience that doesn't know it, the HIMSS program was a way to deal with alcoholics and alcoholism. And we acknowledge that alcoholism is a disease, and it's a treatable disease. And I think that was a great leap of faith that we took in those days. And today I can tell you there are literally, hundreds of pilots, men and women, that have been returned to good careers treating the disability and treating it properly and instead of hiding. And depression is the same thing. I mean, people, I know we like to dismiss it in different forms, but it is an illness, and it's a treatable illness. And handled properly, we can restore people, give them back the privilege to fly again and be properly treated instead of hiding from the issue.
Can you explain how, when it's complete, ADS-B will benefit general aviation?
We only have a half-hour show here. I mean, now, ADS-B is going to be a wonderful innovation. ADS-B, for those listening who aren't from technology, essentially it takes global navigation, a satellite-type navigation, converts that to a signal, and broadcasts it. And it performs exactly the same function that a transponder does today in an airplane, only it does it much more accurately. And we're hoping much less expensively. So there is some concern. People have asked me, well, wow, won't I have to buy some new equipment for my airplane? And I remind them that the rule is not going to compel you to have ADS-B out for a decade. And if you're going to buy, if you have an airplane today with a transponder, chances are you'll probably replace it in the next decade. My suggestion would be replace it with an ADS-B, performance system. So, but the things that we get and we go into next gen and more robust parts, we're going to be able to provide access, horizontal and vertical guide, to places all over the world that have really not the type of traffic that we could justify putting an ILS system, a VOR approach, those types of things. So we're going to enhance safety greatly, going to enhance your situational awareness. You'll be able to see traffic just like the controller sees it, whether or not you're in controlled airspace or not, if you have ADS-B in and out.
And I think a lot of people, especially in general aviation, are worried about the cost and of upgrading. Sure, there probably are lots of safety benefits, but they're worried a lot about the cost.
Well, it's I think if we look at some of the other innovations, if you had a one-off product, yes, they're very expensive. But we're seeing, just think about, and I'm sure a lot of the listening audience has some type of a global navigation system in their car. And the first ones you saw were, over $1,000, then they were $500. Today you can go, to Target and pick one up for $69. I think the same is going to hold true. The rule is now out. The standards are set. You're going to see them mass produced, and I think as volumes pick up, you're going to find that these are going to be very inexpensive and greatly enhancing. Any of the folks who are on the ground here at Oshkosh, the majority of aircraft you see out there are enjoying some type of glass cockpit, and almost all the ones I stick my nose in the cockpit of, I see that they've got ADS-B in capability. They can get the weather information, they can get the traffic information, they can get all of this electronically delivered right into the cockpit with better quality than they would have an airborne weather radar.
We are at the Welcome Center here on Celebration Wave at Air Venture 2010, and my guest is FAA Administrator Randy Babbitt. The sport pilot rule is now 7 years old. Light sport aircraft are built according to a set of standards set by manufacturers and agreed upon by the FAA, which is the ASTM standards. How is this system working out, and what changes might be coming?
Well, I think this system really and truly should be, one of the poster children for government and industry working together. The innovations that have come with the light sport aircraft and the success of this are incredible. The safety records of the light sport aircraft are equal to or better than more highly regulated, constructed type of air. 71 new companies have been created, innovative. Those are jobs. Those are new companies being built. So I think when you add all of this up, if anybody wants to critique it, I think they can't say anything but, wow, we should be doing more of this.
We're talking with FAA Administrator Randy Babbitt. We'll have more questions after a break. You're listening to EAA Radio Live.
The Spirit of Aviation, heard 24 hours a day, all year long on EAA Radio.
And welcome back. We're at the EAA Welcome Center at Celebration Way and Air Venture 2010. This is EAA Radio Live, supported by Rotaway International. I'm Fareed Gio, and we're with FAA Administrator Randy Babbitt, who has had a good week, and he's heading home later today, but he's going to take in a few more sites. What else do you want to see before you leave?
Oh, I haven't spent enough time at the Warbird line. I love to see all the light sport aircraft, and of course, I do have to make one quick run through the fly market. So, on the agenda.
Everybody's got to go there before they go. To continue our light sport discussion for just a moment, training in a light sport aircraft has been difficult during the startup of this rule. A deadline for two-place ultralight aircraft to have their airworthiness certificate amended expired in January. While this rule makes sense, a segment of the ultralight flyers that give instruction in light sport aircraft will go out of business unless a letter of deviation authority, or LODA, comes from the FAA. Is that LODA forthcoming?
Well, that right now, I know it's under consideration. Candidly, I don't have enough technical details to tell you where it is in the process. But we take all of these very seriously. And the last thing we want to do, as I mentioned earlier, with the light sport aircraft, we want to be partners in these ventures. We want to make innovation happen. We don't want to be the barrier to innovation. And so in these ultralights and so forth, we want to work with our partners in the industry, and we'll do what we can. But I can't give you a date or a time where we're going to be confirming what we're talking about.
Well, how about another easy question? Now let's talk about fuels.
Fuels, easy question. All right.
Owners and operators in the piston-driven fleet of aircraft are wondering what will be the replacement for 100 low-lev avgas. Some companies have already started research and have achieved some working formulations of fuel. How does the FAA want to approach the search for the fuel that will replace 100 low-lev?
Well, that's a great question. And let me start by telling everyone in the listening audience that we have a very good working relationship with the EPA. The EPA has their obligations. We in the FAA have our obligations, and we have worked with them and in coordination with them. They completely understand what our issues are, and we have the commitment of the entire industry, the aviation side, all of the whether it's NBAA, GAMA, the different type clubs, are all on board with the FAA to a joint commitment to achieve a solution to have a drop-in fuel that will be available, so that no one is going to have to worry that they've got an airplane that could be obsolete or it's not going to have fuel available to it in some point in time. Let me assure you that we're working with the industry, with the EPA, to make sure we can have a fuel that suits all the needs and all the needs of our operation in time to comply.
Last year, the FAA attempted to implement a one-size-fits-all approach to through-the-fence access at general aviation airports. EAA and its members, I should say, voiced opposition to such a policy, and there have been reports that the agency is rethinking the implementation of that. Does the FAA approve of residential through-the-fence agreements?
Yes, we have. Let me give you the background. There were some concerns, and remember, this didn't become an issue until security in itself became heightened post 9/11. And what we had, policy guidelines were written, and there was a perception that these guidelines were being not uniformly applied around the nation. These are federal rules, but they were being applied regionally with some apparent variation. So in an effort to clear that up, we put forward some advisory type papers to suggest how this would work. We took an additional step, which we don't normally do in the FAA. We invited comments, and we did get them. Thank you. Lots of folks wrote. But we take those very much into consideration, and so we've revised that policy and have circulated the updated version. But more importantly, we went out into the field. There's about 75 airports nationwide that are affected by this residential through-the-fence policy. It's an acute problem at probably less than 10, but it is a real problem. If you're one of the folks that lives on one of those 10 airports, it's a big problem. And so we went into the field, and we still have people in the field interviewing, talking with the owners, what is a better way to do this? And we're taking all of that into consideration, and we're hoping by the end of the summer we'll be able to put out a revised guidelines that reflects a lot of the input. And we certainly won't please everyone, I appreciate that, but we're certainly trying to find the best way to achieve the levels of security and safety at these airports and at the same time accommodate people who live there.
In a statement you made during your confirmation hearing, you said, "My number one priority is to focus on safety. This is a business where one mistake is one too many." Now, most of us would agree with that statement. How is your agency working to allow this doctrine to permeate through the rest of the industry?
Well, we have any number of great outreach programs, and from time to time, we have to have a little call to action on some of them. But I was very encouraged, for example, you've heard me speak on professionalism. We've had summits around the country for airline pilots, and we've had operations and opportunities like we have here at AirVenture, where we get to have forums and open discussions on ways that everybody can make additional contributions. I say it a lot of different places, and I say it in a lot of different ways, but the bottom line is, if you have anything to do with aviation, if you fly the plane, work on the plane, do the avionics for the plane, fuel the plane, ride in it, anybody who touches aviation has an obligation and a responsibility to do the best, the very best they can. And I think you're going to see going forward, our next big step is, of course, safety management systems, where we try to document and have a more formal process for everyone to ensure that they're working at and achieving the highest levels of safety.
Now, our next guest, Sully Sullenberger, was involved in a successful outcome of an emergency, and then there was a crash a month later in Buffalo where it was pretty much the opposite outcome. In the wake of those accidents, the FAA and NTSB have been quite aggressive in examining fatigue, professionalism, and training, as you have mentioned. Mm-hmm. And there were some unprecedented hearings held earlier this year where the NTSB had a 3-day conference to garner non-aviation media coverage and interest. It seemed rather unprecedented that there's this focus on this particular area.
Well, in terms of fatigue, I think the focus is justified. One of the things that concerns all of us in aviation, whether you're a professional pilot or if you're a private pilot, fatigue is something we all have to deal with. It can happen to you in your car. It can happen to you at work. And we all know that fatigue, I sort of make the probably bad analogy that it's not unlike lead poisoning, where it sneaks up on you. And you don't. The problem with fatigue is you don't realize you're suffering from it while you're suffering from it. And teaching people to recognize when they're coming. What are the signs of fatigue? What are the signs if you're in a two-pilot airplane? What are your symptoms, or what do you recognize when the other pilot is showing signs of fatigue? And what do you do about it? How do you measure and monitor yourself? And how much can we do to regulate that? We certainly can change and are in the process of establishing different rules for flight time and duty time for professional pilots. But how does that help us, even if you're in concert and compliance with the proper amount of rest? What do we do about the person that got up at 3 o'clock in the morning to take care of a baby that was sick and didn't sleep for 3 hours and then had to go to work? I can't regulate that. All I can do is help teach people and get the help from great folks like the EAA to spread the word so that people can recognize when they should say to themselves, you know what, I shouldn't fly today. I need to land and get some rest. And
now, a month into your tenure as administrator, you arrived at AirVenture, and you mentioned that you were an EAA-er.
Yes.
And so why did you join? Why did you renew? And what does it mean to be, what does it mean to you personally to be a member of the organization?
Well, the good news, I didn't join that day. I was a member. I used to come to Oshkosh, by the way, before I was the administrator. So I've always enjoyed coming up here, and I haven't come, obviously, every year, but I've come for a lot of years, and I've been an EAA member for a number of years. Aviation has, I've been flying since I was 16 years old, and you can do the math. That's a lot of years. But aviation has been very good to me. And anytime I can find a way to give back, and there's several organizations, I think, do a wonderful job of providing, you know, keeping the flame alive and inviting and making pathways so that our youngsters, the best and the brightest, can get into aviation. And EAA does that, and I'm happy to contribute to it to ensure their continued success. I think it's our mutual benefit to make sure organizations that do these great outreach programs, the Young Eagles and things like that, exist. So, and I'll continue to be a good member.
Well, we're happy that you're a part of it. The previous administrator, David Hinson, approved, or he wasn't the previous, but in past administrator, David Hinson approved the self-certification of medical fitness for recreational pilots, but the Department of Transportation did not allow it to pass. With the sport pilot now 5 years old and few to no medical issues, would you be willing to re-examine the issue and consider expanding the driver license medical to recreational pilots?
We're always open to, you know, re-examining things. Technology makes advances. We have better ways of monitoring people. But remember that there are, in aviation, there are any number of levels of requirements. So as you exercise the privilege of your pilot's license, the obligation of who you're carrying and where you're carrying them and in what rises. So, for example, the pilot in a 777 has to have a first class physical. A pilot flying in a Part 91 operation only needs a second class, and a sport pilot only needs a third class physical, and we're right down into the light sports where they just need to have a driver's license, and that's fine. So the distinction between light sport and sport, we're considering there is an elevated responsibility and therefore an elevated requirement.
Now, I didn't mention this in your introduction, but your father was one of the founding members of the Airline Pilots Association. And so it's been kind of in the family that you've been in the aviation industry. You also are a founding member of an aviation consulting firm. How have those experiences of your family in aviation shape and will shape FAA action on issues?
Well, I think just the broad experience. I think any of us, one of the reasons that I talk about mentoring so much is finding ways to transfer experience, things that I know and have learned, if I can transfer them to others, and I would make an appeal to everyone who's listening. You know, when you have the opportunity to transfer experience to other people, you know, in an airplane or anything in life, take that opportunity, and it's given me an opportunity. I've seen a lot of things. I've flown little airplanes, big airplanes, seen a lot of things in aviation, and I think that it simply helps you with the experience base to help make better decisions for you. So I think just in sum, a great background, seeing a lot of different components of aviation have helped me to be more thoughtful about, you know, what is this going to impact in the industry and who will it impact. And in many cases, I've been there. I've been the impacted. So I think it just helps overall to have the experience. I'm fortunate to have had it, and I hope I'm putting it to good use.
Just a couple of quick questions right at you. Would you fly the Terrafugia?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
What about the Rotable Glass Air?
Maybe.
Okay, the hydrogen-powered helicopter.
Oh, sure. Yeah, that would...
Just like if you would buy a hybrid electric car, would you buy an electric airplane?
You know, that's a great question. I spent this morning over with you're having a big forum here today on electric aircraft. It was fascinating. I simply opened the remarks and chatted a little bit about what that holds for us in the future. But I think that's going to be one of the great next steps for us. We've got some things to conquer, but I'm sure that the innovative, creative Americans and technology from all over the world will give us the confluence of finding lighter batteries that they're efficient, motors, all of these things, because they're great opportunities. So yes, when the technology's here, I think it would be fascinating to have an electric aircraft.
Randy, thanks very much for spending some time with us today.
Wahid, thank you very much. Pleasure.
FAA Administrator Randy Babbitt, stay tuned. Sully Sullenberger is coming up next. You're listening to EAA Radio Live.